Hey, Stickers, listeners of the podcast, Chad here. We have the fantastic Ben Joseph. He's a writer for TV and the internet. You might know him from his work on College Humor. He's done stuff for Dropout. And I'm always kind of like, I feel like I'm passively begging him, like, please, Ben, I just want to play the game on Dropout. Actually, that's my jam. I do that in real life. I correct people and try to gain points about nerd culture. So I think I'd be perfect for it. I guess at this point, Ben, if you're listening, I'm just asking you again if I can be on. Ben's done more than that. He's written for a bunch of cool TV. Star Trek Lower Decks, the arguably much more popular animated Star Trek series than Star Trek Prodigy. I'm totally not bitter about it. Invincible Fight Girl, which is a great show that editor Ben also worked on. Really, really cool. He's written for The Simpsons. Ben's rad, and he came forward with a choice of X-Men E is for Extinction, which is now sort of a legendary run in the early 2000s that really relaunched them. It brought Emma Frost out of obscurity and made her now this main character that Marvel's obsessed with, and introduced the new villain of Cassandra Nova, who attacks people with their mind. And speaking of minds being under duress, I have a disclaimer for this episode. I recorded it with Ben, felt a little weird, I knew I was a little sick. And it wasn't until we were immediately done recording that I realized I had a fever of 102. So apologies to Ben for having to deal with that. Apologies to both Bens. Guest Ben and editor Ben having to deal with that as well. I hope it's not too much of a mess. I got really excited to talk about X-Men. I think everyone on this podcast seems excited to talk about X-Men. It's a series that means a lot to me. I think the new X-Men E is for Extinction run is really, really cool and breaks out of a lot of the 90s tropes you know. Maybe you'll love that, maybe you won't. Speaking of being sick, there's a later plot in these comics where the X-Men realize that Cassandra Nova infected them with little microscopic sentinels in their bloodstream, which is how I've kind of felt this last week. But also, it's a shame that that X-Men series didn't go into, like, we're going into Beast bloodstream and we're shooting all the little sentinels. You know, it's like inner space. I get it. I get why they didn't do it. Grant Morrison is a really cool writer. He always thinks outside the box, very much sort of like blowing your mind all the time with big ideas. And a small disclaimer for that as well. I didn't realize until halfway through the podcast that Grant Morrison goes by they, them now. And I hope I didn't misgender them in the early part before Ben brought it up. Apologies if we did. Definitely mean no disrespect. Both of us have huge respect for Grant Morrison. All of his stories are fantastic and worth reading. We mentioned All-Star Superman, that I think is a really cool book to give to someone who doesn't like Superman stories. I think it's a really rad imagining of like Hercules' 12 labors from mythology. Another one that I always recommend with an asterisk is the three-issue miniseries We Three that is basically Homeward Bound with cyborg animals. And I'll tell you, it's a little heartbreaking. It's a really good story worth reading, but I think it's one where everyone goes, great, never reading that again. Really, really good. Also with Frank Quietly, I believe, an artist who is on this run for E is Extinction as well. Anyway, thank you, Ben, for being on. Thank you, other Ben, for editing this podcast. Thank you all. Maybe one or two of you are named Ben. Would love to know. For listening to this episode. Again, if you want to support the show, if you're listening to this episode with ads, you can get them early and ad-free on patreon.com/storiesthatstick. Get access to a bunch of bonus episodes as well. Our Discord, it's a really cool community, and I appreciate you all especially who support the show in that way. All right, into this episode. Apologies if my brain's on fire. Let's just say it's more about my love of X-Men. Enjoy. I gotta apologize. I am super, super sick. My wife and I are going through it, and I think maybe there's some microscopic sentinels in my bloodstream that are slowly eating me away. I didn't realize it until now, but I think that's why I'm feeling so bad. I should have realized. I feel like metal detectors should have gone off or something, right?
Hopefully a man with a star who may or may not have a star in his brain will come along to...
God, we could talk for 2 hours about Zorn, I think. Let me lay the ground a little bit. Welcome to Stories That Stick. I am your host, Chad Quant, where we talk about stories from the past and the present that motivate us and bond to our hearts. Our guest today is Ben Joseph, acclaimed writer, College Humor, The Simpsons. Ben, am I thinking any major credits I should be listing out?
No, that's great. I mean, you know, lots and lots of cartoons. Most recently, the Rise, Tales of the Ninja Turtles and Nickelodeon. Before that, a show I love called Invincible Fight Girl, Star Trek Lower Decks.
Oh, I forgot you worked on that one. I love that show.
Yeah, yeah. It was. I'm sad it didn't go forever. It was really fun.
I know. There was, I saw like posters for that at Cartoon Network for years. Like it's coming out. And then like the Warner Brothers merger happened and all that stuff. Finally, oh yeah, that was a great show, man. That's awesome. You worked on that.
Oh, thank you.
Ben, you joined us. I asked you to come on. So what story has bonded to you? You picked a bunch of excellent X-Men comics. I think they were all Morrison, I believe. But we settled on E is for Extinction.
Yeah, I think I would say Morrison's X-Men run as a whole, I think, is one. You know, it's I think it is controversial, but for me, it's the best story, I would say, about the X-Men, if not the best X-Men story. And I think E for Extinction, sort of the first six issues, just does such a great job of planting a flag and setting up what his take on the team is and what he thinks about it, and what he thinks about especially at the turn of the century, which I feel like is unfortunately even more relevant now.
Yeah. I mean, I curious, were you reading X-Men before this, or was this like early for you?
I was, like you, I assume, I was a fan of the 90s X-Men cartoon. Yeah. I mean, just, yep. You know, too, yep. Too
bitterly jealous I wasn't working on 97.
Yeah.
Like maybe I dodged a bullet. Yeah.
And I kind of stepped away in my teens sort of out of a desire not to be defined as a comic reader, but then found my way back through actually the Ultimate line, which I think was like exactly what it was designed to do, sort of bring readers back. And then from that, jumped to a new X-Men, which was like, you know, going from like having a glass of water to sort of taking a host to the face.
Well, yeah, you're talking about Ultimate X-Men too, right? Because the Ultimates line was pretty interesting. X-Men, there was Spider-Man, which was acclaimed.
Right.
I think Ultimates, which is pretty good, even if it's like very post-Bush, you know, do you think the A on my helmet stands for France or whatever kind of stuff from Captain America. Ultimate X-Men, I'm assuming. I really actually really liked Ultimate X-Men. I got into it.
Yeah, I think the Ultimate X-Men is really good because it's a great streamlining of like classic X-Men tales throughout 30 issues, and then they run out of that and it just goes off the
rails. Yeah, I think around the time I read a lot of it because I was really on board. And, like, I really like Chris, I'm sorry, I probably say his name wrong, Chris Pachalko's work. I think he works really well for that. But, like, I liked that Bobby was a weird, horny teenager who's, like, perving on Storm. That's not that I like he did that, but it just felt like, yeah, these are teenagers in a school. And I like how, and then around the time that I think maybe around the time that Omega Red showed up, where I was like, I think you guys are running out.
Yeah.
I think you guys are running out of, like, takes on stuff. Yeah, no, Ultimates was really cool. So that came around the same time as this. This is also, you know, new X-Men. It was the X-Men comic that Morrison asked for the new moniker added. I really appreciate that he didn't reset the numbers. That drives me crazy. this is basically a relaunch. I came in, like, right at this, I think. Like,
oh, really?
I think I was reading Ultimates, and then I'm curious what yours was. My first one, I still remember, is Uncanny X-Men. I had written this down. Uncanny X-Men number 394, because it had a real hot cover of Wolverine and Jean just making it on the cover. And it's a cool little self-contained story. They stopped this guy named Warp Savan, who's never showed up ever again. But I was like, okay, what else you guys got? And then I went over to New X-Men, and I just didn't get like Frank Quietly's art. I just didn't understand it.
No, it's kind of a little intentionally grotesque, and I think that kind of speaks for, you know, well, for the first thing is that, like, it's also, if you look at the entire run, Frank, I don't know what Frank Quietly's deal is, but I think he illustrates like half of it, and I think that's purely for scheduling.
Oh.
Yeah, like I think he just had trouble hitting deadlines, but like I think I I'm sure someone will correct me if that's wrong, but
I think
it's a little intentionally grotesque and intentionally sort of non-superheroic. And that's sort of in line with Morrison's take on it as more of like a sort of sci-fi fantasia and less of a straight up superhero comic.
Yeah. As I've gotten older now, I love Quietly's work. I think the one that really clicked for me was, we're going to talk about New X-Men, Ben, I promise. We're not gonna talk about some stuff. But like, I really resonated with All-Star Superman, where I thought Quietly's work, which is also Morrison and Quietly, I thought that really worked of like, yeah, Clark's kind of this big pudge man when he's Clark, you know what I mean? Like, he slouches, and you could buy how no one would think he's Superman. Like, all that sort of stuff was really cool to me.
Yeah, and All-Star Superman is obviously sort of a more singular work, like, and I think, you know, it's not canon, or it's not in continuity And New X-Men is a lot messier, but I kind of love that about it, that it's like feels messy in the way comics are messy.
Yeah.
Kind of, there's like, you can read the whole thing as a novel, but also it goes off the rails in the way every run of comics does.
Yeah. I mean, I think I didn't know, it's really just the same time that Uncanny X-Men comes out, the same year they're doing New X-Men. So they're both propagating the storyline. That was when we're like, Stacey X joins a team and she's like a prostitute with pheromone powers. All that's happening the same time as Morrison's relaunching New X-Men, I think. And that's such a tonal whiplash, kind of like you said. This is a full reset. Yeah, this is like anything that's happened before, don't worry about it.
I mean, literally, I've given other people this rant before, but I think sometimes the mark of a good work of, and I'm going to get real pretentious about X-Men, just get ready.
I think that's going to be clear for this podcast. You're good.
The mark of like a great work of art is like it kind of contains its entire self in the opening and like literally the first page. I don't know if you remember the first page.
I'm actually looking back for it as we go because this comic is so dense. There's so many things happening. Oh yeah, it's got a Bohemian or Promethean man killing monkeys, right? Yeah.
Oh no, it's even before that. It's a full splash page. It's Wolverine killing one of the old Model Sentinels and Scott saying, you can probably stop doing that now.
Yeah.
And it's literally like if in Morrison's mind, the X-Men are a metaphor for progress and the enemies of progress were previously portrayed as this sort of big, iconic, sort of very visible, very like giant robot you can hit. If they're not that anymore, then what are they? And I think that's just like such a great mission statement of the like, okay, the X-Men aren't fighting, you know, big metal races anymore.
Yeah. As fun as it is to fight big metal races, but no, I totally, that's a very insightful take. Yeah, it's totally what he's saying.
And like, yeah, the enemies are going to be more insidious, more, you know, and maybe even within our own ranks. And I think it's just a really interesting, it's just like such a great launching point for like a sort of soft reset of the X-Men.
Yeah. And, you know, I think as a kid, again, I didn't fully read these. I didn't know who Emma Frost was. I was like, who's this lady in like a stripper outfit? I hadn't read her in her earlier runs. Maybe it's worth the highest level to say, like, not only is this a reboot of the X-Men, I think it's two major things, is the creation of Cassandra Nova and I would say the reimagining of Emma Frost.
Yes.
At least reintroducing her and making her her own thing, where now she's like major Marvel character. She's Marvel rivals and everyone's sweaty over her. Like, that's a huge introduction.
Yeah, I actually, my 90s knowledge is a little thin. I don't know where she was between, you know, Claremont and now. But yeah, this is clearly a very different take and kind of the take we that is still around.
Yeah, they refer to her as a teacher already. So yeah, we can set the table for it. It is, like you said, Cyclops tells him, Wolverine, the time has passed. We are no longer going to do this cool stuff. We're going to do other cool stuff. Cut to, I love this. This is so Morrison stuff. Like, I love the cut to a void where we are seeing prehistoric man, like, kill Neanderthals. And like, that's how it is. That's how it'll be now. As an unknown woman in a, I think it's called a pith helmet. Is that what you call that?
Yeah.
Explains to a strange man. It's basically like the X-Men are a really small group. Like at the Xavier Academy, what, there's like six of them? I don't know. It seems super small.
Yeah, I think they do say like five full-time teachers. And in this take, this is before Decimations, there's still like, it's still full of students. But yeah, in terms of the team itself, it literally is like five people.
Oh God, is Decimations the run later where they like made a bunch of really cool teams and then they just murdered all of them?
I actually thought Decimation was No More Mutants, right? With Scarlet Witch.
Oh yeah, I forgot that name for it. Which is, yeah, that could be talked for hours about.
That was No More Mutants / Fox Owns the Mutants. We're not going to be telling stories about
that. Right, I was thinking of the one, this happens so much, and maybe it's worth getting into. This happens so much of the reset requires us to kill a bunch of mutants. Yeah. I think House of M is a pretty cool, you know, story, even though it irrevocably changed stuff. I was thinking of the one later where it's like, I think after this, Ben, it is, we are Emma's a team, Scott gets a team, we're all going to do, like, clubs, right? And, like, the Hellions are reformed, Scott's got the Corsairs, he's leading a team, and it's like, wow, we're really going to actually lean into the, like, I don't know what you call it, the Riverdale, the Saved by the Bell of, like, there's 30 kids.
Right.
And what are they all like? And at one point, they all just get on a bus, and then the Purifiers kill them. Like, it was just one of those, like, what? That's, like, years of buildup. What are you guys doing? But this one goes into, starts with a genocide. Starts with a fun genocide.
But yeah, you're right. Starts with, you know, there's a sort of tubby, middle-aged, average human being told by a woman in the fifth helmet, hey, your hatred of mutants is justified. Their emergence means that humans are going extinct, just like the Cro-Magnons, or just like the Cro-Magnons killed the Neanderthals.
That's coming for you, and you got to defend yourself. And I love that we don't immediately know who this guy is. He's talking, he's like muttering about a documentary he's seen. But yeah, I guess you're right. Even though at the school, there's a lot of like characters that are there who are just in the wings, right? Like there's probably 20 or 30 students, there's a few teachers, but name any other claimed X-Men character you like, no idea where they are.
Right.
Where's Rogue? Where's Nightcrawler? Where's all these, like, maybe they're in Genosha. We don't know. We're not seeing them right now. I love the setup for it. How do you feel? Cause I think we go to the Xavier Institute, kind of just going through the major beats of it, is we see a new transformed Beast. And I want to talk to you, Ben. How do you feel about secondary mutations?
I think it is a clumsy in-universe device, but I think the results are very fun. I love that we get Diamond Form. I love Cat Beast. I mean, even if like the sort of reason for it doesn't make sense, I think the results justify it.
Yeah, I agree with you. At the time, I was like, "What do you mean secondary mutations?" The whole point is they get one. but for listeners who haven't read, Beast has basically gone from like monkey ape man to full on, maybe too close to Beauty and the Beast, but he's a full cat. I love Cat Beast. It's great. He's talking about how, like, he's dealing with the fact that his fingers can't, like, operate machinery anymore, and he's trying to relearn stuff. He's still horny. He talks about being horny.
This is also, I would argue, the start of the arc that they just reset. This is the start of, like, sort of Evil Beast. This is the word.
Yes!
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't want to side tangent you, Ben. Beast is someone I love as a character, but I feel like in the last couple decades I've read of Beast, besides the Dark Beast, which is interesting, right? What if Beast went crazy and mad scientist, all that stuff? It feels like every couple of years in X-Men, Beast fucks up. Because they're trying to allude to, well, he's Dark Beast. That's his inner nature. I don't know. Like, let Beast be cool. Like, let him be rad. But
yeah,
tell me
if
you disagree.
I mean, I don't. Have you read? I do think they literally just brought back 90s Beast into the personality reset on him and said, he's fun again. And I think that's...
Oh! Is this post-Krakoa?
Yeah, this is post-Krakoa, where, like, Beast literally became, like, evil Henry Kissinger of Krakoa.
Yes. He was doing, like, he was making, like, spy gear. That's where I was like, Beast, what are you doing, man? And, like, yeah, very. You could tell they were going towards Dark Beast.
For yeah. Sure. And I think they literally, like, opened a tube or cloned him. And now I think we have, you know... sort of Spider-Man One More Day style, we now just have back to sort of the fun ape again.
sure. I mean, I guess development for him is interesting than just being in the back. But yeah, I love Cat Beast. We quickly learn Emma Frost, who is the... we're kind of jumping over. So by the way, Genosha is a mutant country that was formed before I started reading, but it's like mentioned for the last 30 years. Genosha is like... I don't want to reference a real world period, but I feel like it's like a way you talk about like Jamestown or something. Like just like Genosha was an event. It's 9/11 for mutants, right?
Oh, you mean in terms of what happens in this book? Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Just like I feel like I always grew up reading about Genosha. I'm like, that's probably a thing in the 90s where it really bad. No, like, or Genosha's been killed multiple times. This is really the main destruction of Genosha, a country that Magneto made the United Nations give him to placate him. I never read any of those comics with Genosha, like any of the stuff where, what is it like to just have a city with the mutants? Which I guess is Krakoa now, like 20 years later, that's kind of what Krakoa could be.
Right. But I guess Genosha, they kind of set up as like mutant refuge. Krakoa is like we're a nation state that operates on the world stage. And that's kind of the...
Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, no.
Krakoa is the much better version. I find Krakoa very. I wish it had not gone so fast.
No, but yeah, as you're talking about, like, yeah, this whole arc starts with the wiping out of Genosha, and I don't think as I was reading it, I understand like what a big deal that was, sort of for mutant kind.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think this book is fantastic, so I don't mean to knock it too much. I do think it's interesting that the X-Men barely mourn it. Maybe it's all happening off screen, but they kind of just move past that. They're like, my God, Magneto's dead. Everyone else is dead. We won't say their names because again, I don't know how this works. Uncanny X-Men had like half of this team and like Chambers in Uncanny X-Men. So I don't know if that's just, we're not worrying about the canon. Don't worry about it.
No, I think that's one of the reasons it's so polarizing is that it works very well as a standalone sort of story from beginning to end. But also you kind of do have to discount like, the continuity of it all.
Yeah.
You know, which like with All-Star Superman, you don't have to think about that because it literally is just a self-contained story. But yeah, here, I think the people who like this arc the least are the people who are deep in X, who are reading month to month. And so this hit them. They're like, wait, what is this? What's happening to my beloved X-Men?
Yeah. Yeah. And I get the need to move past. I think like, and I want to go more through the story beats too. I think overall aesthetically though, it's interesting how much this feels in conversation with the 2001 X-Men movie, right?
Like, yes, yeah,
we're not wearing the colored costumes anymore. We're all going to wear cool blue, yellow, and black leather suits that are kind of different. it is a cool look. Like it looks rad, but it's much more like military psyops or something.
It's funny. I was going to say that's the one thing it has in common with Ultimate X-Men is they both make a crack about not wearing superhero suits, which, you know, it's fine. It was Gen X. It was the end of the 90s. I don't know that.
Yeah, that first X-Men movie too, where it's like Storm. What do they call you? Wheels? Like that's very like just we are embarrassed by the property a little bit.
Yeah,
trying to put it through like the Matrix filter. I guess it worked. I was totally down. And it's crazy to think like it took like 25 years for Hugh Jackman to be in a blue and yellow suit.
Yes, and now we have mixed feelings about that because
now I would say like the end of the run we finally got it. So this is like both kind of like pivoting off of that. I feel like that connection is going into it, and then there's also we can get like some stuff with X-Men 2 that I wonder if like those writers were reading this and in tandem. But we're getting ahead. We're getting ahead. You were laying it out much better, Ben, and I jumped ahead of you. So. This unknown Pith woman has taken a chunky man who is airsick to, what is it called, Guatemala? I'm trying to remember where it actually takes place.
Oh, I forget. Some Central American country.
Central American country. Behold, look at this. A master mold was constructed in a building. But do you mind, feel comfortable explaining what a master mold is?
As far as I know, a master mold is like a sentinel that makes other sentinels.
Yes. Yeah. It's a mama sentinel.
Yes, a mama sentinel. That's her baby.
Every time the master mold goes, you're my baby, I'm your mommy, and then kisses it on the
tough
head.
Tough conversation everyone has to have. Where do sentinels come from?
I mean, there is a lot of in utero stuff in this series. Yeah. But yeah, I don't think we know yet, but we'll start to quickly learn that this guy that Cassandra Nova is bringing along is the son of Bolivar Trask, a pretty famous creator of the Sentinels. So he's a key. He's a tool.
Yeah, because Bolivar Trask created the Sentinels. His genetic code, his voice print sort of can control Sentinels. And so this woman has gone and found this nice, liberal-minded dentist who is related to Bolivar Trask and is using him to sort of activate the master mold and take control of the Sentinels. I do think it's very intentional that, like, there's a couple lines that, like, sort of Get Out style. This is a guy who has, like, the correct opinion about mutants.
Yeah.
And is sort of, like, talked into genociding them over the course of, like, you know.
Yeah, two or three pages.
Yeah, exactly.
No, I agree. That really stuck out to me because I, you know, what we know about, and at this point in the story, we still don't really know who Cassandra Nova is. She's got her head in a cerebro, basically, this whole time. symbolism. But, like, In hindsight, you know, she could just take over little Trask's mind and make him do this.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
And it seems like she's enjoying pushing him.
Yes.
Like, or it's subtly she's doing it, but it feels like in every other part of the story, she just takes what she wants, right?
Yeah.
And this is more like, I'm going to enjoy watching him fall.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, there is a throwaway line about her having to, like, copy all of his genetic code, and that took hours. But yeah, I think you're right that it is interesting to, like, see that this is one of the only times where she persuades someone as opposed to just, you know, hijacks their mind.
Yeah. So I believe kind of what happens next is while that's going on, the X-Men are unaware. Cyclops and Wolverine have picked up a stray mutant. That's what they were blasting that sentinel about called, I think, Ugly John.
I think so, yeah.
Poor Ugly John. He just has three pig noses and they are flying him back to the Xavier Institute. I love ugly mutants. Like, I always find this part of the story interesting of the, like, the ones who don't get to be cool, right? The Morlocks. We're not snazzy and models, so we kind of have to hide in the underground. You guys have no idea what we're dealing with.
Yeah. It's something that, you know, a little bit, like, I think it took a couple, like, there's not a lot of that in, like, the sort of, like, Lee Kirby run, but the time you get to the 90s and the 80s and the 90s, there's definitely sort of that, like, a little bit deconstructionist take that, yeah, isn't it weird that these mutants who are supposedly hated by society, that Xavier has only assembled the hot ones? And,
I only want 10s in my school.
And I do think Morrison's run is sort of peak weird mutants. Like the whenever you get a campus shot, there's a lot of them. And yeah, like right here, yeah. They do bring up the point that, like, this guy they've rescued has three faces. That's his only power. He's not attractive, and he's not useful.
Yeah, he's going to be killed just because of his mutant gene, yeah. Right? And then I feel like John's a little bit of a, I mean, he's a red shirt. Poor John. Yeah, every time we come to the school, some of these, like, mutants, I think, are ones Morrison created. Glob Herman. I fucking love Glob Herman.
Oh, yeah, Glob Herman. Yeah, it's funny. Like, yeah, if you want a mutant, if you want a character to stick around, like, regardless of characterization, he's given a real cool, fun design
Yeah, so he's like a skeleton in a giant gelatinous blob, and his eyeballs are out. I was joking with some friends last week, like, you know, if I was going to put Tim Robinson in any Marvel stuff, I'd make him glob her. Also, he talks about skeletons all the time. Yes, it'd be really easy to do. Yeah, so while Team Cyclops and Wolverine are bringing Ugly John in, they get shot down, I believe. I'm sorry, is this after... this? Dude, every page is a new crazy event.
So, oh, yeah, no, the I mean, it's all very propulsive, and it's all very, like, linked, but it is super dense. And I think what happens is that Xavier is, like, demonstrating his new Cerebro, and you get this very cool visualization, and there's, like, a spike in Central America, yes. And he sends them to go investigate the spike, the sort of mutant ability spike, and that's when they get shot down.
Yes, and Cerebra to show that it's been rebuilt, even though it seems to be the exact same thing. Is this around the same time that, like, as soon as he taps in and checks on an area, Cassandra's just, like, waiting for him, right? Just starts diving into his mind, is very much like, you won't be able to form a single thought. I'm going to make you a murderer. You're my oldest and last enemy. And Charles goes for a gun to shoot himself.
Yeah, it's a very impactful image. It's a little bit like 90s edgelord, you know, just like...
Yes. Get out of my head or I'll fire.
Yeah, Professor X carries a gun at all times, just in case.
Yeah, I hadn't even thought about how he's just strapped all the time.
But no, it's a very cool image that, like, yeah, someone tries to take over Professor X's mind, and he basically, like, says, you know, if you do it, I'm going to shoot myself in the head. And this mysterious presence, who we now know is the woman in the pith helmet, backs off, lets him go. But there's someone out there who's calling Charles her oldest enemy.
Yes. Yeah, and who knows who it is? I'm not going to get too far. I don't think Charles knows. Is he aware and he's been hiding this, or is this I genuinely forgot?
I don't think he knows. I think once we get to the, you know, if you just, I don't think he knows.
Okay. There's an infamous page about their origins we have to talk about, yes. Even if it's not the E's for Extinction. Yeah. So we're cutting back and forth between this and Cassandra Nova, who is like, well, that was fun. I'm no longer in Charles's head. Let's go to the Master Mold. And I guess this is a new concept of wild sentinels. Like, the Master Mold was just gone unfurred for so long. They're just these, like, little guys, like grasshopper robots with guns and no uniform, like, design to them. It's a neat idea, and they stop for Trask.
Yeah, yeah, that they're very, the Master Mold has been using whatever around to make sort of these wild sentinels. And yeah, they obey Trask because he is related to their creator.
If you put, this is a dumb question, but if you put a Master Mold in, like, a bake shop. You know what I mean? Like, obviously it takes wood from Ecuador and all this, but if you put it in a bake shop, would it be like, yes, cupcakes? Would it, or just be like, no, we're making a...
No, I think in Chad Quant's X-Men run, we can have cake, cake sentinels.
Canceled immediately. Cake sentinels? It's just Nightcrawler talking about religion and cake sentinels? Immediately fired. So the X-Men are flying overhead. It's just Scott, Wolverine, and Ugly John, who will be immortalized forever in the X-Men. They're going to put a big plaque for him. They're getting ripped up by the Sentinels. I love that Cyclops is already like, I can tell these things assimilate. I can't let them get this ship, so I'm going to crash the ship.
Right.
Just the cold steel he has. they eject, badass shoot. And yeah, now it's Logan, Scott, and Ugly John in Ecuador, basically just kind of getting their asses kicked, right? Like,
yeah,
John takes a shot to the knee. Sorry, go ahead.
Oh yeah, no, yeah, because they run into Cassandra Nova. Because at this point, Cassandra Nova has murked Trask, right?
Yes, yeah, she's at least assimilated his code or has control over it. So they're working on behalf of her, and we see a cool, like, creepy spider one go to capture Wolverine.
And we see, I don't know if we want to bring it, but the effect that one of the few elements they took for Deadpool and Wolverine, the she can stick her fingers through your face effect.
Yes. Yeah, that's so crazy. Like, that's such a rad visual. I mean, jumping into, like, how do you feel about the Cassandra Nova Deadpool Wolverine version?
I mean, it's a funny use of the character. I think it's kind of gets at what is interesting about all of Morrison's work is that it's all very metaphorical. And if you describe it literally, it just sounds kind of trite and goofy.
Yeah.
Like if you're like Cassandra Nova, Professor X's evil lady twin. And that's like, you know, and that's obvious. I mean, the funniest thing is they made her young and hot. Like, that's the...
Oh yeah. You know, they couldn't have an old lady.
No, I mean, but, No, it's cool. She got to be in live action, and I hope Morrison got paid.
I wonder. He probably didn't. Yeah, you know, he got like a created by credit in the back. That's a whole other thing about why our writers not bringing cool new characters to the House of Ideas in DC, right? Why would you do that when they'll just own it? Yeah, no, I love Cassandra. Like, it's not like sexual in any way. It's just I'm running my hand through you and your face, and I've assimilated your DNA. Like you said, I don't need you anymore.
Right?
He's dead. He's this dentist who was turned to be a fascist bigot is dead. And it was, I think, one of the Wild Sentinels brings in Cyclops. I think what I like about this is it doesn't seem like she knows which one they are, right? Because, like, she kills Ugly John, just zaps him, makes a really cruel joke about how he smells like bacon because I guess he was a pig man, and then just doesn't realize that Wolverine is the next captured X-Men.
Yeah, well, I also think that sort of gets at the characterization of her is that she's more of an elemental force than she is like any kind of like sentient being.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
She's doing an imitation of humanity, and she just kind of has this like sort of deep, you know, she's Charles's id. She's this deep suppressed rage. And so like, I think it's kind of cool that she's not like that her vendetta against the X-Men isn't like personal. It's just kind of like, you know, a biological drive.
Yeah. No, I think that's a really good point. Later on in the story, I think this is past the use for extinction. Like, she just becomes almost a child panicked over her body as she's been jumping forms, right?
Right,
she's,
yeah.
There is sort of a childish there. Do we want to get into her? We can get into her origin later. It's just so fascinatingly weird.
Yes.
Because, like you said, well, it could just be Xavier's twin sister who died in the womb.
Right.
But also, there's 10 times more things than that. I guess we'll just get into it. Sorry, this is like I read all of the Morrison stuff all the way through Imperial when we were talking about this, and maybe we can get into it. So there's a lot of stuff I might be like jumping ahead on, but I wrote this down because the term they give for her, I was like, oh, this must be something that he pulled from, is a mummer dry. I'm sorry, that actually is a real cultural thing that Morrison stole. I can only find it on X-Men, so I think he made it up. A parasitic life form born bloodless on the astral plane. So she wasn't a baby originally,
right?
I think,
but Charles Xavier was such right. The idea, and I might get some of this wrong, but again,
no, it's really hard to follow.
Yeah, with Morrison, it's all kind of like feely and sort of effervescent anyway. But like
it's jazz,
basically, yeah, exactly. It kind of is. But basically, all of us have like a shadow self that we defeat before we're born. But Charles is such a powerful psychic that his was literal. That he had that his shadow self was a literal twin in the womb. Then a very sort of like probably intentionally funny sequence, we see fetal Charles Xavier defeat fetal, literally punch in the face fetal Cassandra Nova.
I think he must have thought, he must have known, I am telling quietly, right? Babies punch each other in the womb. they all have adult eyes, and one starts to choke the other with their umbilical cord. It is so bizarre. Did you ever read Venture Brothers?
I watched. Doc Ventures has a half or a brother who's like was a twin in the womb, right?
This is I kept thinking of that. That's at the end of the season one reveal. He's like, you sucker punched me in the womb. Then he's been growing as a vestigial twin. But this is like the cool art form of it, right?
Right.
This is the like it's bizarre. Yeah, and then like you have shots of, I mean, it's really dark. You have as he's defeating his sister in the womb with like a psychic light blast, his mom falls down the stairs and then has a miscarriage. And then I think it's mentioned that Cassandra like is growing from the sewers for like years.
Yeah. Whatever cells like sort of, yeah, ended up in the sewers. And again, because Charles is such a powerful mutant that like the cells are able to reform themselves into a body. And now 60 years later or whatever, she's Cassandra Nova, and she's sort of coming back for revenge. Mostly, you know, we think she hates mutants, but it's really that she just hates Charles and still sees like the world as the womb that they were both inhabiting and that only one of them can survive.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point to it. Because it is, yeah, it's like anti-mutant, but she also doesn't like humans. You're right, she's a destructive force. Who also, I guess Wolverine Deadpool did this too. It's like she's got kind of reality powers, right? Like at one point she's just forming a metal suit out of like nearby stuff as Wolverine attacks her. She's pretty OP.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. I mean, we got to nerf Cassandra Nova, guys. She's, but no, it's very true that like her powers are not clearly defined. She can kind of do anything. But I think also that's one of those things where like if you take telekinesis as a base power and you make it powerful enough, people can just do. If your power becomes manipulating atoms, then yeah, they can do literally anything. It just doesn't. it's one of those things where you can't think about it too hard, otherwise the comic kind of falls apart.
And I, like you mentioned before, House of M, I kind of liked at the time what they were doing with Scarlet Witch, even though maybe it broke her as a character. This, like, we are addressing the fact that a reality warper is too strong to also kind of, like, retroactively explain things. It was like a canon coverall, right?
Right,
like,
right.
Anything that didn't make sense, like, the best one they always talk about is, how the hell did Wanda and Vision have kids? He's a robot, right? And then it's like, oh, well, that was a dumb comic thing, but now we're saying, like, she manifested them out of reality, and that's, like, a fundamental part of Wanda now.
Yeah.
Or I'm trying to remember the other ones where it's like, I feel like I'm blanking on this. I thought I had another example. I don't. let's talk about Ugly John. Ugly John has yet to be killed. He got fried. Wolverine's got Cassandra in a headlock. He's like, my adamantium blades shoot out 113 miles per hour. Just make a move. And again, the tone of this, while he's holding Cassandra, Cyclops walks in, his visor's gone, and you have Wolverine just basically asking Cyclops, like, put the kid out of his misery. He's, like, dying and burnt. Just shoot him. Just, like, shoot him off screen with your laser beams. That's so dark, man.
It's really dark. It's, yeah, it's, I mean, Scott in general, and I think, you know, I didn't read a lot of the 90s, so I don't know how much of this has precedent, but the sort of deconstruction of Scott in this arc is one of my favorite things. Like, what happens when sort of the pragmatic Boy Scout cracks?
Yeah.
And yeah, and it leads to some really cool and funny moments.
I'm with you. I'm usually the guy, like, I think there's kind of a mainstream thing of, like, Cyclops is lame, right? Wolverine's cool, and I kind of feel the opposite. I, like, well, Wolverine's kind of, there's great Wolverine stories. I'm way more into Scott. I think what he's dealing with is so much more interesting. I had to look it up. I didn't realize that starting in this new X-Men, I guess in the last year, he had been possessed by Apocalypse.
Yeah, they reference that. I've never read that story.
Yeah, so I was like, okay, I guess he's got some shit in his head. But Morrison's kind of playing it more just as, like, you and Jean have marital problems. Like, yeah, you guys are unhappy.
Yeah, the midlife crisis of, hey, we were high school sweethearts. We, you know, we kind of, like, built our relationship around this shared dream, and what happens when that dream kind of starts to fade a little bit.
Yes. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Maybe that's not exciting for high schoolers, but I think, like, you growing up on the cartoon and stuff, I found that more interesting than just, and they were best friends, and Wolverine was the third wheel. you've read Krakoa. I really actually enjoy what they did with Krakoa, which was implying at least that Cyclops and Jean and Wolvie are in a threesome.
Yes, I love that. I mean, I actually think, like, after New X-Men, you know, that's kind of the next definitive X-Men story. I don't think there's really anything between that sort of does anything radically new.
I'm a big fan, and I know he's a creep. I loved Whedon's Astonishing, which I think is after this, and that's also, like, Cyclops rocks, right?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
Whedon's like, Cyclops is cool, Wolverine's lame. Now, through the filter of what Whedon did, I'm like, oh, of course, thought the nerd was the one that was coolest. But yeah, I think that's kind of the major House of M's between those two things, right? And it's, like, the reactions to what Wanda did. But tell me if you feel otherwise, but I loved the House of M event. I thought it was really, like, one of the best Marvel events they've ever done, and how it had ramifications. But also, it did kind of feel afterwards like Marvel didn't know what to do with the X-Men. Like, it's sort of just sad stories of, I was the Blob, and now I just have skin everywhere. Like, that kind of...
Yeah, no, it does really... I mean, I also, I do like, you know, Whedon's downfall aside, I do like Astonishing, and I do like it as a counterpoint to New X-Men, just because it's so much like, okay, Grant Morrison did the mind-bending kind of, like, now here's X-Men as a weekly hour-long drama. You know, here's Whedon.
Yeah, kind of the same team, right? Yeah, like, they bring in Kitty and Colossus. But, like, so many cool moments in that. I think that's also to the artist's skill.
In terms of House of M, I think it's just interesting how much of that era can just be dictated, you know, not to read outside the lines too much, but just, like, Marvel and not owning the X-Men film rights and just not caring about them seems like it's just so defining of that era.
No, the hardest time to be an X-Men fan in the last couple decades is that bureaucratic corporate stuff of, well, we don't have the rights to the mutants. So, Inhumans, guys. Inhumans are cool. Which are, like, no, Black Bolt's rad, right? Like, he could kill you with a word. But, like, they're just so... Please tell me if you feel otherwise. I just find they're so...
No, the stop trying to make Inhumans happen era of Marvel was very embarrassing.
and they did that by also making the Marvel mutants, like... I don't know. They were kind of on the wrong side, where they were, like, hunting down Inhumans and, like, fully unaware of what they are as a minority. It was a bad time. It was a bad time for mutants. Thankfully, corporate mergers happened and all's okay. I think the next thing I have up, Ben, is actually the genocide of Genosha. We talked about Evance. I think while this is happening, Cassandra starts her thing. She sent the Sentinels off. We get a shot of Genosha of Emma Frost teaching students. No one in the class that's memorable other than Megasonic Teenage Warhead, who's also in Astonishing X-Men. Not sure what her power is other than she could just see death coming.
No, kind of a prophecy. And also someone who's, just because of their name, I think, was repurposed into Deadpool.
Absolutely. The only reason, yeah, because I wonder if now in the comics, especially after Krakoa, they probably reinvented her to have, I don't know, I have telekinetic charge or whatever, right? She had in those movies. But like in these comics, she's almost a cliche, like Lydia Dietz times 10 goth who's just kind of sad and sunken eyes and talks about the world ending. It's a very different character.
But yeah, to your point of Morrison possibly not doing justice to the end of Genosha, she really does just exist to be sort of like to make us feel sad, you know, sort of put a face on the genocide as a whole.
Yeah. And you, yeah. So I don't want to get on my soapbox too much with you, Ben. I really appreciate you coming to the podcast and just rant about X-Men. I have a particularly strong response, maybe negatively, to maybe it's obvious, mass genocide of a species in comics. It sometimes feels a little cheap. The scale of it is so beyond what you can imagine that unless it's also like the next year of comics is about this, you know, Genosha or how Krakoa ended, really bummed me out. That even if you know those falls are coming, I feel like it has to be done personally. I feel like it has to be done well for me to feel like it has the weight it deserves.
I agree. Especially for a comic that is so sort of interested in commenting on the current moment. The fact that, like, you know, it really does feel like Grant Morrison said, hey, the story I'm telling does not involve a nation of mutants, so I'm going to get rid of that nation of mutants. It's going to be part of the story, but I'm not, you know, that's not what the story is about. And yeah, I agree. One of the weaknesses of this is that feels a little tossed off.
It's to give Cassandra heat, I think, to use a wrestling term. Yeah, right. Like, oh right, my God, look, right. Look what she just did. A big old blimp-sized
fresh off the death of 16 million mutants. Yeah.
By God! Sentinel blimp. I that's like issue 3, I think, ending of it. A big, pretty big destruction. Cut to time has passed and Beast is making dark humor jokes about skeletons. I don't know how to break this to you, but your dating days may be over, my friend. It's fine. He says gallow humor is getting him through it. I don't bump too hard on that.
Out of Genosha, they go on a rescue mission, and we get basically established that Magneto is dead, or is he? And Emma,
we got to talk about Zorn after this. Yeah,
And Emma Frost comes.
Yes, Emma Frost staggers out, cool, badass. I know she was part of the Hellfire Society, right? So like being sort of posh is all of her thing. But yeah, if she really comes out, I feel like pre-made to be this character type, right? Like, I'm only one survived.
Yeah,
Negasonic saved me. I don't know how that possibly tracks with her being one of the villains in Astonishing X-Men. Don't worry about it, it's comics. But she's like, she warned me and a secondary mutation popped in. I now have diamond skin. I'm different than you, Gene.
Which is great, which is such a fun, because, you know, I think when I read it at the time, I didn't even realize that she hadn't had diamond powers before, because otherwise she's just a psychic. And that's kind of like, we have a lot of those already. Yes.
I'm all for different. Do you play Magic the Gathering at all, Ben?
I have, not recently.
This is an awful comparison, but I feel like it's fun to have, well, we already have a bunch of red mana decks. What if there's like a red blue deck? You know what I mean? Like just like a
throw
one in there so that Emma stands alone because she can be sort of a bruiser. I think, oh, man, the movies did not do her justice by any means. I do love Emma in the comics. And I will say, I kind of like her and Scott together more. Is that a hot take?
I mean, that's kind of New X-Men is kind of an argument for that.
Yeah.
Literally, the last page is Scott agreeing to sort of live life as symbolized by kissing Emma Frost.
Yeah. I mean, again, shouldn't have done it with an affair or cheating on Jean. That's effed up. But in terms of if these people were all emotionally mature and had conversations and talked about it, I do find for the next decade so plus of dynamic of Scott and Emma as sort of a like more, I wouldn't say confident, but a more direct power couple versus Jean, who is, no knock on Jean, she's got a lot of issues, right? She's constantly possessed by the Phoenix. She's kind of always doting on the professor. Like, she's a very different dynamic for Scott as a couple than Emma.
Totally. It's a little bit like Scott's like Spike and Angel.
Sure. Yeah.
There's like the icon. There's sort of the iconic like doomed romance, and then there's the blonde who's a little bit like shittier and maybe worse for him, but is a much more interesting story.
Yes, and I can't fully say for the Spike, and I haven't seen all of those episodes, but I know what you mean. Maybe Emma could have, like, spent a little time with Scott. She moves on him, like, quick. She's like, second day, yeah. I'm coming to your bedroom in a brassiere with champagne. She is, like, hard going.
It's also funny because it's a psychic affair, you can almost see if it's something that, like, Scott justified in his own yeah. head. Like, no, I'm not actually cheating. It's just, you know, which I think they even get into in the book. But it's just interesting, like, how do you get Boy Scout Scott Summers to cheat? Yeah. Oh, it's all
he would never. He would never physically lay with her. But he would totally have thoughts. And I think that's an interesting, like, you know, Emma comes out of the dirt. She's like, I'm the only one alive. Don't check for any other bodies. We're good. That's a joke. They know. They can sense who anyone's around. But Emma's got diamond skin, and she can't use her psychic powers while she's in it. I don't love how they first draw her with diamond skin. She kind of just looks like she's got jelly all over her.
Sure, yeah, yeah. Maybe a coloring issue, who knows? But yeah, no, it probably takes a little bit to figure out exactly how to make her.
Yeah, and what she even is. So what happens next? Xavier's like real sad over what happened. Magneto's dead, gets like one or two panels, but we have this woman captured in a sort of a cool stasis pod. What are we gonna do about her? What do they do about her? I think they just experiment on her.
I think they have like literally 5 seconds before they're like, hey guys, don't worry, we have this stasis pod that was designed for Juggernaut. It should be totally cool. And then 5 seconds later, she just breaks out.
They really got to put like a lock on that cabinet for her. She is getting out. I mean, even at the end of this, is sort of like the defeat of Cassandra Nova. No. This is Morrison's brand new toy. He doesn't want to be done with that yet.
The holidays are almost here, and if you still have names on your list, don't panic. Uncommon Goods makes holiday shopping stress-free and joyful, with thousands of one-of-a-kind gifts you can't find anywhere else. You'll discover presents that feel meaningful and personal, never rushed or last minute. Uncommon Goods looks for products that are high quality, unique, and often handmade or made in the U.S., Many are crafted by independent artists and small businesses, so every gift feels special and thoughtfully chosen. Chad surprised me recently by getting us some spooky garden rocks. They're decorative rocks for our front garden that look like spooky ghosts. Couldn't have asked for anything more perfect. Uncommon Goods has something for everyone, from moms and dads to kids and teens, from book lovers and sports fans to foodies, mixologists, and gardeners, you'll find unforgettable gifts that are anything but ordinary. When you shop at Uncommon Goods, you're supporting artists and small independent businesses. Every purchase is a chance to choose something remarkable and feel good about where your money goes. And with every purchase you make at Uncommon Goods, they give back $1 to a nonprofit partner of your choice. They've donated more than $3.1 million to date. So don't wait. Make this holiday the year you give something truly unforgettable. To get 15% off your next gift, go to uncommongoods.com/goosebuds. That's uncommongoods.com/goosebuds for 15% off. Don't miss out on this limited time offer. Uncommon Goods, we're all out of the ordinary.
Yeah, we have a little bit of Beast and Frost connecting, understanding the secondary mutation. It's cool that they're both going over this. I keep going back to this, but I do feel like Beast should have to be thinking about, like, well, my secondary mutation made me more of a monster. You are diamonds. Like, just at some level of, like, the question of where the mutations go is so compelling. And
right.
I don't know about you. I feel like if I was a mutant, that's a dream, Ben, to be born as a mutant, to get to go to Xavier School and be taught by Gambit. That's my dream. I know that I wouldn't be a cool X-Man. I would just be like, we're going to get into him later, Beak, who is this like very physically disabled X-Man because he's like part bird, but he doesn't have wings. He knows that he's ugly. He looks like a Skeksis from Dark Crystal. That sucks for him. That's like such a shame. He gets nothing to do to help the team.
And that is true, but I think Beak has one of my favorite arcs where like he is obviously like not useful, but he like he gets a love interest. He gets to have kids. He gets to, you know, he gets to sort of save the X-Men a little bit. And then when you flash forward to the future, he has this extremely buff grandchild.
What does that look like? Like a super chicken? What is that?
Oh, it's in Here Comes Tomorrow, there is an extremely like part of the so the last arc is a flash forward to the future, and one of the X-Men is like Beak's grandchild, who's like literally a buff bird man who carries a bat around. Cool. And there's this very touching moment where he died, where I found it very touching. It might be ridiculous, but he's like, I'm so sorry. My one regret is that I never lived up to the legend of my granddad Beak. And Wolverine's like, dude, you're like 6 inches taller than your granddad was. You're like, you've accomplished way more than he ever has, which is so funny. That, like, you know, just a nice commentary on like, you know, generations and parenthood and how like, even if, you know, how your like legend can loom large, even if, you know, even though he was not a physically impressive person, like still like his legend like lived on.
That's really cool. I didn't know that. I mean, I'm trying to say, like, who does he get with? His wife, Angel.
Oh yeah, it's Angel. That I think it's in Murder at Xavier's. That they have like a, it's real gross. They have like a sack of eggs, and they have a bunch of like a room full of eggs, and they have very like classic cartoon like half Beak, half Angel babies.
Cool. And like, then what? Wolverine's like, we can't let these live. Like, what does he say?
No, they're just like flying around the campus for the rest of the series. But it is very funny. That's like, you know, in Shrek when the donkey gets with the dragon.
Yeah.
And the babies are like half donkey, half dragon. It's just literally that. Like it's that theory of genetics. Like,
and I guess because their parents are mutants, their babies just start with mutations. It's fine. That's
another thing that Morrison plays fast and loose with. There's a couple of moments where like, Grant Morrison is non-binary. I hope we've been gendering.
Oh, I hope so too. I did not know that. Thank you for correcting me. Yeah.
Yeah. But where Grant Morrison a couple times throughout sort of implies that there have been mutations at birth. And I think they go out of their way to like justify that it's a anomaly. But yeah, again, playing sort of if you are a longstanding X-Men fan, another thing that might ruffle your feathers in terms of how it all works. Yeah. No pun of yeah.
No, that's really cool. I know we talked about just doing East for Extinction. I don't want to fully get into all these other ones, but I think you brought up Angel. I don't see Angel in the X-Men comics much more, but this definitely was like a year or two of her. Angel's got a way darker story. We don't have to get too into because it's sad, but like being abused by her parents, there's some level of physical, mental, and maybe sexual abuse. She just has like a bad skin condition. Before she runs away from home in a poor home. And then I think she's found the next day, like she's cocooned and now grown butterfly wings and can spit acid.
Right, or not even butterfly, like fly
wings. Oh, that's right, it's
like
fly wings. It's like, less. I kept thinking about like who I see much more in X-Men. And again, to bring it back to it, it's like Pixie is in X-Men a lot more. And Pixie's kind of the same thing of she's a young girl who can fly. But she's photogenic and she's got beautiful pink wings. And, you know, like there is a bias towards it. I think that's really... It sticks out to me a lot.
Yeah, and I think the Angel stuff I do like. I think it's a little bit just like giving Wolverine something to do.
Yeah.
Like the classic, like giving Wolverine a young woman to take care of.
The next Jubilee.
But they do have a fun dynamic. And I like the Beak Angel relationship a little. But yeah, it is an interesting new take on like an Angel, not erasing the previous Angel, but just like literally a young woman who's named Angel.
Yeah. And I think she's the one they brought into what was the flashback Cold War X-Men movie, First Class, right?
Yeah, she's in First Class. I think she's Zoe Kravitz.
Yeah, she's Zoe Kravitz. The casting in that movie is insane. Like who they it's like Angel, Azrael, who's from I think one of the worst runs in X-Men ever, is like Nightcrawler's dad, who's the devil, is just there. It's like, why are you guys picking these people out of the lineup? I don't know. It stood out to me a little bit. Angel's got a little bit more of a chip on her shoulder. She comes into play later. But the main characters we see in kind of this overall arc is, Beak, Angel, and they haven't really shown up yet, but I'd love Ben to talk about the Stepford Cuckoos.
Oh, the Cuckoos are great. Are they? They're Morrison creation,
yeah,
right?
I believe so. I looked them up because... again, his comic pacing is so interesting. Things just sort of happen in that moment, and the characters talk about it as if it's always been that way, right? Like, there's just sort of lines. I'm trying to find the exact page where they show up. Emma's just suddenly teaching them. Like, she's after this main Cassandra Nova thing, and we've had some side detours into Zorn and all that stuff. Like, Emma's just got five twin blonde girls who all call her like, you know, Master Miss Frost or whatever, and they're like a hive mind, right? The five in one, what they're called,
right? Yeah, and it's I mean, again, like visually, it's just a very fun idea that Emma Frost has sort of five Heathers who follow her around.
Yeah. Yeah. I guess she found them in the class and was like, you're coming with me.
And of course, that's later all explained in sort of insane fashion why they look at her. But I almost like it better just unexplained.
No, agree. I had never read that explanation. Yeah, I agree. I liked it when it was just they're twins. They like Emma's style. She takes to them and she makes them a very formidable sort of like five person psychic force. Not later on. Sorry, Ben, if you remember this better than I do. Like later on in the comics, they are clones of Emma. And they were put in the Weapon X program. And at one point, yeah, it's so gross. Like, at one point, Emma was, like, in a coma, and they took her egg cells. Like, it felt like a writer needed to explain why do they look like Emma.
Which we didn't need. I think you might have read it more recently than I did. But, yeah, that's also, you're also getting to Morrison. I think it's Morrison's innovation that what if Weapon X meant Weapon 10?
Yes.
Which is like,
sure, sure.
What if X-Men 10 is what I think is one of Morrison's, like, I think it comes up a couple times.
Yeah,
Hickman, obviously. That's what I was thinking of. Hickman is the other person that says, what if X-Men 10?
I actually like that because I think it's cool to have, I mean, you're already going to have like, was Sabretooth part of Weapon X, right? It was like Omega Red part of, like, just having a, it's going to be cool numbers, guys. It's going to be, you the nerd can designate in your head, Phantom X is whatever, 13, and the Stepper Cuckoos are 14, and there's supposed to be 1,000 of them. Like, there's 1,000 cuckoos in a lab somewhere, which I think is too much. That's too many cuckoos.
too many.
No, I love the cuckoos. I think they kind of, they get sort of red-shirted a lot in the comics, right? It's like, well, we got 5 of them. We could kill one.
Yeah, well, even in this run, there's one who goes and dates Magneto.
She dates Magneto? I remember dating the slime alien thing in Imperial. She dates Magneto, too?
Oh, at the end, one of them goes full fash, and when Magneto reveals himself and does Planet X, he has a Stepford Cuckoo as like a consort.
She's like 17.
Yeah, I think it's supposed to be gross. I mean, do you want to talk about Morrison's treatment of Magneto?
Sure. No, because I think we're near the end of this 3-issue run of Ease for Extinction. I think we're kind of talking about past that. Let's talk about Magneto, please.
Yeah. So. Immediately retconned, but you know, the big revelation is that in the first half of New X-Men, they recruit this presumably Chinese mutant named Zorn, who wears this big metal helmet and his power is that he has a star in his head, so it gives him all these electromagnetic
abilities. He looks fucking cool.
And he sort of like cultivates his own class at Xavier's, you know, sort of this own special class of rejects. And the reveal is eventually that Zorn is Magneto, and the entire purpose was to come in and sort of destroy the X-Men from inside. And that leads to sort of the second to last, the penultimate arc of New X-Men, which is Planet X, where he basically, in his sort of anger and rage, does another Holocaust.
You think he would know better.
And I think that is Morris, you know, by this time, sort of the late 90s, Magneto had been reformed and sort of, I actually don't know when Magneto, you know, like the sort of like completion of arrival of the Malcolm X, Martin Luther King, Magneto.
It also helped that Ian McKellen was just so charismatic in the movies. We want that in the comics more, please.
But no, Morrison is planting a flag for better or worse and saying, no, you guys are all wrong. Magneto is a maniac, a genocidal maniac, and a supervillain. And that is a take that does not last basically beyond the end of New X-Men.
No, and so yeah, again, like you mentioned, he's like a prisoner in a Chinese camp. The X-Men come to see him just because, like, I think he's suicidal. Like, there's something you got to help talk him down out of this because if he explodes, he'll kill all of us. Yeah, that mask is so cool, man. That Zorn mask. I know it's just like skeleton with metal bars across it and blue smoke, but man, that's a cool design. I know Morrison says it. It's not that I don't buy it. I just don't get how that's Magneto. Like, I just don't. I don't.
No, it's a lot of Morrison stuff. It works better on a metaphorical level than sort of a literal level. Like the idea, I think it's very purposeful, but that by the end of New X-Men, both Xavier and Magneto are off the table, and we've seen both of these sort of endpoint of their philosophies and how they failed.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think like really interesting sort of like within the course of this, looking at this as one story. Afterwards, Marvel was immediately like, no, we need Magneto back. Yeah. That actually wasn't Magneto who did a Holocaust in Manhattan. It was Zorn who thought he was Magneto because of the drug he was taking. I think it was because...
Was that kick that everyone was doing?
Yeah, I think it was. Because even within the story, that's how they justify it. They're like, oh, Magneto's taking kick, and that's why he's sort of doing the horrible things
he's doing. Sure, not to side tangent, but when, you know, the other story we talked about reading, which I had a really fond memory for, the arrival of Quentin Quire, a little mutant... I don't know if you'd call him a fascist, but he's definitely dressing like a little Nazi, is like taking over the school, right? With like a more militant group of like, kill all the humans. And now Quentin Quire...
Well, yeah, I think it's...
No, go ahead. I was like, now Quentin Quire's just like, beloved scamp, he makes telekinetic shotguns. But like, he's kind of an interesting bad guy the first time he comes up.
Yeah, because he's also, you know, to talk about the relevance now, is he's a disaffected young man who thinks Professor X's kind of like liberal get-along policies are a failure. Yeah. And that leads to him being... someone who could be very progressive, that leads to him being radicalized into basically a young Nazi. And we find out by Magneto,
yeah,
in disguise as Zorn. But yeah, the other reason that's given is he's taking a kick.
Yeah, that's right. Like, don't worry, he was a little on edge. Yeah. He's dialed down. He also has a relationship with one of the Stepford Cuckoos. I do love in all those later comics where the other Cuckoos are like, gross, Esme, like, what are you doing with Quentin? Like, he stinks. The Magneto thing, Listen, of course he's not going to be dead, right? Just it feels more shocking gotcha of Magneto. I sound like CinemaSins. I'm sorry, Ben. He dies in Genosha.
Right.
Probably overcome with rage. And instead of seeking out who did it, like, I mean, imagine if he had shown up and helped fight Cassandra Nova, right? Like, right. I've discovered what happened and I'm here to help tip the scales. And now you have Magneto at the school, which happens later anyway. He puts on a costume, gets arrested by the Chinese government, uses his magnetic powers to fake his abilities. So I guess like the whole he has a star for a head thing is just like he's messing with the machines or whatever. And he's a healer. They keep calling him a healer with his energy, but he just has magnet powers.
Yeah, no, it's insane. Again, we haven't even talked about we referenced Kick a couple times. We haven't even talked about the fact that Kick is actually it's a drug that enhances your ability, but it's actually a microbe in vapor form, a sentient microbe in vapor form that hates mutants because it doesn't believe in evolution. Name Sublime, yes.
Oh, Name by Sublime. Yeah, this was I hadn't remembered Sublime. He's like kind of the main villain of this sort of middle, like this main Morrison run that I had a collection of is like bookended by arrival of Cassandra Nova, quote, defeat of Cassandra Nova. We kind of skipped over. Like, I think Emma just like breaks her neck, right? Just shows up and Diamond form, didn't see her, breaks her neck. Cassandra's dead for a while.
Right.
Then, while she's, whatever, reforming, gestating, the X-Men have taken their eyes off of her, there's this stuff of, like, Sublime as a businessman who is making human that are grafting mutant organs to themselves to have powers. That's, like, a trope in X-Men, for sure.
Oh, yeah. But also interesting, like, sort of in this, like, overarching metaphor of what is the new, you know, what are the threats to progress? What are the enemies of the X-Men? It's almost people who envy them.
Yeah.
Which I think is interesting. But, yeah, no, it's... So yes, that's how Sublime is introduced, and we're told by the end, because he's also the main villain of Here Comes Tomorrow. Oh, okay,
you know, I somehow missed that run. I really should. It's like a small one, yeah.
But no, when we flash forward to the future, so Sublime is introduced to us as a businessman. It turns out that he's actually a sentient microbe who had taken over this guy, and that he's like secretly working against mutants across the board. And it ends in the future because after Scott has abandoned the X-Men, Beast started taking Kick to like sort of stay on top of things. And Sublime takes over Beast, and the final villain of Here Comes Tomorrow is a white Beast who is, you know, been taken over by Sublime.
Is that the origin of Dark Beast?
No. Dark Beast, I think the actual Dark Beast was in the 80s, and he was an alternate universe.
That's Age
Beast.
Of Apocalypse, but right? I think that's like Beast, yeah.
Yeah, Age of Apocalypse, okay. Beast. Yeah. But I think this is the first time where we see sort of like, hey, even the trajectory of Nice Beast, because he's sort of got like this sort of like ends justify the means element to him, that on a long enough timeline, Beast might become evil. I think this is the first time.
Yeah, and you're right. Calling him Krakoa Henry Kissinger is very apt, right? He is like, I've bioengineered these special plants to spy on everyone, and we need to do this, and I think it bites them in the ass majorly by the world. Beast just keeps fucking up. I don't want to get fully into all of these because I can't keep you here for 3 hours, Ben, but I think these major characters he brought in, I think the themes you're getting at is really interesting of like what I feel like the other go-to X-Men besides the villains besides the Purifier are like the Purifiers, right? Who are like the religious and they hate them and like Stryker, and I guess those are similar also sometimes getting into jealousy, but yeah, this sort of like X-Men are cool and how we react to it. I didn't realize until reading this, like, oh, is this when X-Men are like in the public knowledge? That's this issue?
I'm actually not sure about the idea. It feels impossible, right? That this is the... Because we also... Right. So basically, they think they've defeated Cassandra Nova. It's eventually revealed that Cassandra Nova has hopped into Charles Xavier's body and is controlling them. And she controls him and has him go public with the X-Men, reveal that he is a mutant and that the Xavier Institute is a school for mutants. And yeah, it feels impossible that that's the first time that's happened, right?
It must have been retconned at some point, and then Doctor Strange made a spell. But, I mean, going forward, that sure seems to be the status quo for the next 2 decades. I guess in my mind, even that first X-Men movie, they're sort of like, well, it's secret, but like people know, right? Like people are figuring it out. I think there's a competing school later, like Frost runs like the Massachusetts Society or something that's like less liberal, peaceful school.
Right.
But yeah, that's just like a fundamental change for everything in these stories runs, right? Like going through this, going through the next like 2 decades, I guess kind of ending on Krakoa has similar... I keep going to Krakoa. I think there's an interesting like hand-in-hand with what Morrison did here.
Yeah, no, because I think it's kind of like, you know, the X-Men as a superhero team as sort of a metaphor for othering is great, but like it's kind of the question of where do you go once you've told every X-Men story?
Mm-hmm.
And I think Hickman and Morrison both had very different answers for that and in ways that were kind of like both revolutionary for the franchise.
Yeah, yeah. And I kind of cynically as a kid when I was reading House of M was like, you guys have made too many mutants, literally what Wanda said. But like, if you guys want to keep any level of a thematic scale of we are hunted and minorities, you can't have 10 million of them kind of thing. We need to scale it back. And therefore, that all goes that way. It was a cruel reset, for sure. Do you mind talking for a minute about Krakoa? I just think like that's the most excited I've been about X-Men in years was the Krakoa era.
Oh, it was great. It was such good storytelling. And like, I just think the idea of what if the mutants finally said, okay, we are stepping onto the world stage. We are stepping apart and defining ourselves apart from humanity. And we are going to be a country. It's just such, and what are the challenges of being a country? And what are the challenges of exercising your power on the world stage like that? I think it's just so.
Yeah. And I want to remember the timeline wise, you know, around the same point, like Black Panther did so cool with making Wakanda this sort of like futuristic utopia, right? Of like, we have found a way to protect ourselves. And Krakoa feels different from Wakanda in, kind of like we don't get involved, right? That's like Killmonger's whole thing in the movie. And Krakoa is like, no, we'll let you know where we are. Hands off. it's so like open arms of, and we've established portals all over the world that'll only let a mutant in. And if you're a mutant and you need safety, come here. Like you're immediately here in Xanadu. We're making like free medicine for the world if you want it.
Right.
All of these things, and then still like who pushes back on it, who's terrifying. And the other, I feel like it's a really cool, interesting meta thing on comic book rebirth of the X-Men can't die in Krakoa.
Yeah. Like, yeah, because that's kind of the whole thing is like, yeah, stakes, death is an easy shorthand for stakes, but we always know the X-Men come back. What if you just take that off the table? What if, how do you tell stories then?
We found a combination of five. I love that they're called the five. Which is like a Fox News stock program now. The five that are like, what is it, like Hope, Summers, who she has some sort of spark. I feel like the whole Hope stuff never really made sense to me. Cronus or Tempest, Ava, who can like rewind time. It's like this combination of like, and oh yeah, Mr. Incredible, Professor Xavier has backed up everyone's mind on a server. So, right? So it's like you, wherever you were in Krakoa last week, if you die, you're back to there. We'll bring you back. And then Gold Balls. I love that Gold Balls, who was this like joke character I think Bendis made, who just fires gold balls from his tummy, was like, oh, those are actually eggs. We could use those to make...
You can grow a human inside a gold ball.
Yeah. That's such an interesting, and like it gets into weird stories of like, what's the cue for who gets brought back first, right? Like there's sort of a politics system, the Quiet Council that are like all the heavy hitters sort of just talking about Krakoa in clandestine but open meetings. I'm just listing off things I love Krakoa.
No, I think it's because New X-Men is so sort of like metaphorical and abstract, and like the more concrete you make it, the more it falls apart. I feel like Hickman is the opposite. I feel like Hickman in also a great way, it's just a very literal writer.
Yeah.
Like he kind of like really You know, the fact that you get those graphs every
oh my god, yeah, there's so much incidental material, like what you'd pick up in a video game of like, here's a dossier.
Like they both kind of dive deep in their own way. Morrison's just is kind of like a mushroom trip, and Hickman's is like a technical manual. And that's, I think they're really both very awesome. You know, it's just like two very valid ways with two very different results to approach this kind of mythology.
Yeah, I think Krakoa ended too early. There's some, I try not to read too much of it, but there's some level of like scuttlebutt over like Hickman left when he wanted to versus they wanted to change it, and then he had a third stage plan. I don't know how much of that you've read, Ben.
Oh, yeah, no, I've heard the same. I mean, I think definitively he did not get to sort of see out his plan for it. Yeah, no, I think the House of X, Powers of X is such a good,
oh my God, so good
story and ends in such an interesting place. And I'm not sure any of the stories that came after really do it justice.
No, I always felt like there was good potential in all of them, right? Like, I really liked The Marauders, even though it's like a side book. It's like Kitty and Emma Frost are like essentially, I think they're just pirates, like protecting the shipments of free drugs. Like, it's like a side story, right? The one that I was always really drawn to, and I think it was kind of wasted potential, was I think it's called Way of X. Did you read that one?
No, I didn't.
It's super small miniseries. It came on early on, but I think it was the most interesting idea, where it's like the first issue, now that we, you know, all the mutants know that you can just die and get resurrected. And it's sort of like kind of culturally like celebrated, right? There's even a like, I forget what it's called, like Exodus or Apocalypse run this like fight ring in the open where it's like, if you want to be reborn, fight and we'll kill you, right? So you can get, like, you're part of the club now that you've been reborn if you've been living this whole time. So that Nightcrawler's on this mission with a small team. Funny enough, I think it's Pixie, who we talked about earlier. And Pixie and these teen mutants are talking about being reborn like losing your virginity. Like, very, very much like teasing, I think, Pixie for not having done it yet. Like, well, you're dumb. You haven't died yet. Like, that kind of thing. And they start fighting some, like, purifier fascists. And Pixie, I believe, listeners, tell me if you remember this differently. Pixie, like, toys with the guy and, like, draws the shotgun to her head and encourages him to shoot her. And then she dies and is resurrected the next day, and all the kids are like, ah, that was wild. And like Nightcrawler is like, holy shit. Like, what? This is real bad. Him being sort of like the one religious person in Krakoa isn't like, I'm going to keep doing Catholicism, but I think we need a religion. Like, I think we need, which just sounds kind of like, well, I don't know. Like, but some sort of like morality, right? And I think that created the start of, there was like three rules that are like, make more mutants, like go ahead and have sex. Like, don't hurt another mutant. There's like the rule of robotics, whatever. Right. I thought that was an interesting thing to dive into, the cultural fallout of none of us can die.
Yeah, absolutely. And just also that we've created a nation overnight. What does that mean? What do we stand for? How do we conduct ourselves?
Yeah. And all of the moves they're making are, I mean, God, I think it's one of the peaks of that run is the first Hellfire Gala, where it's like, what's going on here? And then Emma and the team are like, well, by the way, we've invited you humans and Avengers and beloved celebrity cameos, Patton Oswalt, you're in the background, to watch as we colonize Mars. Like, in one night, all of our, you know, omega level mutants, what is it, like, Bobby collects all of the moisture in space or whatever, and Magneto collects all of this, like, they basically make a giant reactor that terraforms Mars in one night. And that's so cool. And I love everyone's response to, like, okay, are we just fine with the mutants taking our other planet, you know?
Yeah, the Hellfire Gala feels like something, no matter what else sticks around for the Krakoa era, it feels like that was sticky enough that it's going to come back. Just, you know, if nothing else, an excuse to put everybody in sort of formal wear. For the
night. My God, yeah, the designs are great. Yeah. I mean, I know I find it more interesting than the Met Gala, which has its own real-world problems. That's clearly the inspiration, right? Like, here are some power players.
Right.
All getting to do new stuff. And then I think the second one was like, well, we're all getting killed by Nimrod.
I'm just shooting from the hip here. I'm not sure how, because I didn't read all the stuff that came after House of X, Powers of X. But it's interesting that I think one thing they didn't really service is that in Hoxpox, it's that the overall threat is not humanity. It's the singularity. It's the AI apocalypse.
They do it a little bit. Go ahead, please.
Yeah. And it's interesting that in New X-Men as well, the thing, you know, the thing that ends up to be the sort of theme is that the thing that they're trying to avoid is the same thing, but it's a biological singularity. And it's just interesting that, like, two writers who think deeply, like, that's what they, you know, that is the eternal enemy of the X-Men and of progress. Just the idea that we should all be the same.
Yeah. I think that's really insightful, Ben. If you shot from the hip, you got me right in the chest. I think that's what I also really like about, and why you mentioned X-Men, why I was so excited to talk about it. There's such a fun, beyond being, I think, just one of the most fun comic book teams in existence, like, they feel like they have so much material to play with than I don't know. Like, Batman's great. I feel like there's less to analyze about Batman. Someone's going to be like, you're wrong. There's 10. You know what I mean? Like, just like other run. Even the Avengers. There's sort of a little bit like, yeah, well, maybe Tony's kind of like a military, you know, complex guy. But just the X-Men feels so ripe for that all the time.
Yeah, just it's so flexible, too. I mean, I think, I again, there are probably people who can speak to this way better than us. But just the idea that, like, it was teen superheroes. It was an excuse by Stan Lee to give five. He's like, I don't want to think of five different reasons for powers. Yeah. And but then, like, you know, the fact it became a space opera and a soap opera and, you know, and just all the different things it can be. It's just so flexible, but also all feels like X-Men.
Yeah.
I think it's great.
I'm glad they're back. I'm not reading any of the current runs. I'm still sore about Krakoa, honestly. I want to go back there.
I think I have read a little bit. I think it's a little, unfortunately, Krakoa was so definitive. And like much of media, I think they're just trying to make it the 90s again.
Oh, my God, yes. Absolutely. The new launches I saw were like, everyone's back in their original outfits. Yeah, it's I get it. It's still, if you worked on a Marvel comic, Ben, I wouldn't blame you for going 90s, right? I'd still be tempted to do this.
But just, you know, just like where like business models worked and everyone was making money and things were popular, and now just like in sort of this new era of media where nothing reaches anybody, you know, yeah, it makes sense that you try to go back to your sort of when you were at the height of your powers.
I don't know if we're going to, not to be too futuristic, I just don't know when we're going to get, the fact that Hickman even got to do his is so wild because it's, you know, it took over the entire run. Every book had to acknowledge the fact that there's a mutant utopia, right, and how it's changing. I guess beyond, funny enough, like the Hellfire Gala is sort of the most mainstream thing of like, hey, people who aren't reading the comics, look at these rad fashion, you know, like look how cool Cyclops is coming down the aisle. But it's such a like heady thing, right? It, and even every issue is like, well, who are they fighting? Like, what's their main conflict? Oh, is it internal? It's just hard to get that across. I'd be surprised if Marvel does that for a couple of years.
Yeah, I'm also, I mean, I thought Thunderbolts was one of the better recent MCU movies, and I'm excited that that guy is tackling X-Men.
Oh, you know, I didn't know that.
Yeah, yeah.
I have not actually watched Thunderbolts yet. I've heard it's great. I love the Thunderbolts comics. I think they're I'm sure no one's had this complaint but me, who hasn't seen it. I was bummed that Thunderbolts had no one besides Shooty Shoot people. But like,
yeah, they do make fun of that in the movie. But yeah, no, it's not. When you say Thunderbolts comics, are you talking about the
like the most recent run I read? This is probably like a decade ago. Was like, yeah, Man Thing, yeah, is their teleportation.
Norman Osborn in charge.
Like they're using Man Thing as essentially a teleporting ship. Dr. Hyde and Satana. It's weirdos, right? Like I think Ghost is in
right.
it. But like Ghost is a weirdo. He's like a little creepy dude who phases through walls and is probably on a list somewhere. Like it's much more, these are out on the fringe people than kind of fallen soldiers.
Yeah, no, again, similar to New X-Men, if you were going to the Thunderbolts movie expecting like Thunderbolt loyalty to the Thunderbolts comics, you I think you would be disappointed. I think but still the team interplay is very good. It's like a tight and well-written. And yeah, I think hopefully that'll do well for X-Men. But yeah, there's no, I think my Thunderbolts era is the Norman Osborn.
Oh. Dark Reign, is that what it was?
Yeah, Dark Reign. Yeah, which I think is real dark and fun. But yeah, no similar.
Dark Reign is fun. Either. That is for listeners, that is like post-Civil War. All of the baddies have won over America. Norman's in charge of the Avengers and is basically just lying to the people that like his team are the originals, right? He's like, he's got like doppelgangers of everyone. Like Venom is, I don't remember who Venom was supposed to be in that. Like,
no, wait, Venom is supposed to be Spider-Man.
Yeah, I don't know. He's constricting himself or whatever. Yeah, it's like a bunch of like, I got those. And that's where the, I remember like the Iron Patriot suit is like Norman's taken Tony Stark suit. And that's in like Iron Man 3. As a one-off. No, I liked that too. It was almost should have been funnier that they had to pretend that they were Avengers. There should have been more like, we're doing press, we're doing photo ops. People are starting to be suspicious. Venom keeps eating people. No, that's also a great run. Ben, I mean, I think I kind of hit the beginning, but I'd love to hear more too. Like, to wrap this more back up, you as a writer, do you feel like X-Men and Marvel stuff has influenced your writing at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I feel like this run in particular, just really the idea of, because I think sort of my favorite lane to write in is kind of like action comedy,
sure,
genre action comedy, and specifically stuff that's like, you know, deconstructs and subverts a little bit. And I feel like that's really, and you know, not just in the kind of like an eye rolly quippy Joss Whedon way, but like in a real like, okay, but what does this mean? What is like sort of a giving characters like real flaws and psychologies and not just making them heroes. And I think, you know, I say that's a guy who writes mostly cartoons for children, but still, like,
dude, same. You're saying the same thing as I am. I'm telling deep stories about trauma. No, I totally get it.
I think everything I aspire to is like what Grant Morrison does when they jump onto a franchise, just telling something that's really like earnest and deep and resonant, but also like funny and interesting and subversive as well.
Yeah, that's a great way to say. I mean, I imagine I kind of was too, even if I was put off by Quietly's art. Again, Quietly's a fucking legend. I just was wrong as a child. People who were brought in by these comics, right? Who were like, I can get that. I understand who those people are. I'll watch this. Or I'll read this. You got to have this. Do you have a cast your own team? Like, you're assembling a team.
I jested. We did this in the room for the show I was on most recently. I wonder if it's in my notes. If not, I can try to freestyle.
Yeah, no, if you put me on the spot too, I would probably have too many options to go through.
But I think, yeah, it was Nightcrawler, Cyclops, mm-hmm. Colossus, mm-hmm. Kitty Pryde because I'm boring.
No, Kitty Pryde's great. She's always good.
And someone's like, oh yeah, because you're a white dude in your 30s, of course.
At least you didn't do whatever, Bendis or whatever. It's like, yeah, the Kitty dates a guy who looks like me. Yeah, that kind of.
Yeah, yeah. And Storm, I think, was that five?
I think it's five. Would you, not judging all, would you, if you had to throw in one weirdo, like one outlier.
Oh, I really like Brew. You remember
Brew? I loved Brew. Wolverine and the X-Men was a really fun run. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I had a friend who got to write a Brew Iron Man team up, and I was very jealous of them.
What does that story even go as? I'm looking that up.
I forget. There was a talk. Maybe it was Jason Aaron's run. There's like a throwaway line where Iron Man shows up and he's like, "Hey, you know, there's an internship at Stark waiting for you if you ever want it." And Brew like shows up and does right. that. And
Brew is the one person from the Brood alien Zerg race who just like didn't connect with the hive mind. Right? He's like, "I'm just a little guy."
Right? Because he was a mutant. Because he mutated and like his mutation was to be separate.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I love that one. Brew's a good pick. No, I miss Brew. That entire like we're just talking about different runs. That like Wolverine and the X-Men run. Where I actually didn't mind Wolverine being the lead of the school, and they're like dealing with the Little Hellfire Academy or whatever, right? Where it's like four children of the Hellfire trying to fuck them up. I was like, this is kind of fun. Like, this is, you know, it's still stakes, but it feels a little more tongue-in-cheek in a cool way.
Yeah, Jason Aaron's, I think, I really enjoyed that run at the time. It was way campier than I remembered it, but like in a good way, in like a fun way.
Yeah.
Because I also he introduced Bamfs, right?
With Bamfs, my god, those are the little demons guys.
Yeah, the little night crawlers that are like infested the institute like rats. Yeah.
Yes, yeah. He made like Dupe. I never was an ecstatics guy, so I never really cared knew what Dupe was or Boop or whatever, that big green blob guy.
Oh yeah, who was the receptionist? Yeah, I think.
I'm always a sucker for. Maybe that's me going. Want to go back? Like, just let them be in a high school. Like, let them have some drama. I think I was kind of rooting that for the entire movie run of all of them. They kind of do it into, but just, I don't know. Let me see some teenage drama and dating and frustration over powers. And one gets brought into the X-Men team for an episode. And I'm assuming you saw, what was the one of the last X-Men ones? Is where they first brought in Kid, Nightcrawler, and Cyclops, and Sansa Stark was...
Oh, was it Apocalypse?
Maybe it was Apocalypse, one? Yeah. And I remember in the trailer for it, in the ads, it shows, like, the kids. It shows Psyche and Jubilee and Nightcrawler and Jean, like, at the mall, right? And then that scene's not in the fucking movie. Like, it's not... They clearly cut it. And then you only see them coming back from the mall to set up a Quicksilver, like, does a super speed time slow thing to save the school as it blows up. I was like, I want to... No, but bring me back there. Take me to the mall. I want to spend time there with these kids.
Yeah, it really feels to do that justice, you have to have, like, an early 2000s like teen drama with like a budget of a prestige streaming show.
Yes, yeah.
Which is all I want to write on, but like I don't know
I don't know if they're making those anymore. Dude, totally. Please sell that and hire me to work on an episode because I would love to write that. That's a great team. I don't know if I could actually top yours. I'd probably Ben go. Sorry for the overlaps. I go Nightcrawler. He's my boy, number one. I love Nightcrawler. I'd probably go Rogue because I'm a sucker. I can't say no to Rogue. I think I'd actually put like Blob Herman in, and I'd want to find his secondary mutation. Oh, like I wouldn't want to like make him not what he is, just like I'm a monster, look at me. But the same way that I think in Whedon's Astonishing he kind of took armor and made armor sick, I would love to do that with like Blob or someone else in that kind of lower tier. And then I guess I need like a flyer or something, you know. I would be interested in bringing... my first comics I ever read was Extreme X-Men, which was like Claremont's like last stuff, and it's super obtuse, right? They're like in space, and I think that ends just as New X-Men starting. But I think someone from that team would interest me, including Cannonball.
Oh, yeah.
Cannonball would be interesting. Or he had a sister that they've probably done nothing with since called Lifeguard. And
I remember there was a period where the Guthries were like sort of...
you're right. Yeah, and there's the brother that like sings and has beautiful wings. Yeah. But like, I guess she's really just Darwin of I evolve into what I need in the moment. But I thought it was an interesting idea. So yeah, I like that Claremont basically made like surfer siblings, right? Like Cannonball's like on a surfboard and Lifeguard's just doing a Baywatch thing. Yeah, Ben, I've talked your ear off on this. Please let me know if you think there's any parts of this run that we didn't get to talk about, any gripes you have. Anything else you want to share?
No, as predicted, we kind of just like spent 90 minutes talking about X-Men, which is all I ever want to do.
Yeah, same.
It was great. I really appreciate you having
me on.
Thanks,
Ben. Thank you. I encourage all listeners to check out, I think, all of Morrison's run, even if Zorn being Magneto is stupid. Zorn's pretty rad. Yeah, Ben, where should people follow you on social media?
Oh, I am barely on social media, but I'm on Blue Sky. Maybe I'll get back on that at some point, but... Yeah, I think I don't. There's nothing coming out right now that I'm writing on. But yeah, find cartoons that I've worked on and watch.
Yeah, Invisible Fight Girl, who our editor Ben worked on as well. I'm sure Ben was stoked that two Bens, the two Bens. Of this episode. Ben, thanks for having on, man. I'd love to have you on again to talk something either more X-Men or something not. But it's always great talking to you, dude.
Yeah, sounds good, man. I'll talk to you soon.
And if you want to support this show, there's a few ways to do it. You can tell a friend about the show. That's huge. That's way better even than social media. You can leave us a review on iTunes or Spotify. Like, for example, we got a review on iTunes that says 10 years and more from the original crew to the new chat era. I have greatly enjoyed this podcast. Pulling back the curtain on R.L. Stine's atrocious work had been a laugh riot for over a decade and shows 90s kids... maybe their childhood faves weren't all they were cracked up to be. Despite some curious hardline opinions on other generational staples like Sega and Sonic the Hedgehog and Incubus, truly a laugh riot. 5 stars. I stand by all of those opinions. Thank you very much from I'm Just John. Really appreciate that review. You can do the same on Spotify. Anywhere like that helps us get noticed on the algorithms. And the number one way to support the show, just go to patreon.com/storiesthatstick. You get access to bonus episodes every month where Jacqueline, Heidi, and I are reading through Goosebump books and other YA novels voted by you on the Patreon. I think coming up next is Animorphs. I'm very excited about that. We also have a campfire hang every month with me and editor Ben going over the new media, the new stories that stick. There's a lot of X-Men conversations in that as well. We get those every month. You get access to ad-free episodes early. And you also get access to our Discord, and you can vote on what we're covering next. That's patreon.com/storiesthatstick. Thank you all to support the show. Couldn't do it without you. Thank you again to Ben for being on the show, and we'll see you all next time. This episode of Stories That Stick is brought to you by our wonderful Patreon supporters, especially those in the Book of Names. Starting with Stefan Jive Turkey Kuwabara, Hollis Hornbeak, Nathan Dolezal, Hey Josh Rob, Afshin, Buddy Morrill, Mel Dipson, Stealth A Beautifully Fleshed Skeleton Bates, Robert Moon, Jason Crooker, Zentacles, The Juggalobalist, Aiden Wants to Take a Nap, Aiden, that's my life, nonstop, all the time. Gail, formerly GDW. Jar Jar Slinks, Chosen One. Clay Castle, John Keaty. Miguel Pardo, Calf. Yanni Markovina, Anthony Mulberry. Carl, Brooke X. Christian Van Skeever, Jeremy Lowe. Jonas Engman, Zach Connor. Luke. Elusive Koala. Where is he? Where's that koala? Jesus Christ! Brian Hopgood. Tom Whittem. Tevin Ticklebean whispers, rich people are a scam, and releases the arrow. I just assume every month you release a new arrow, and someone new dies. That's how I view it, Tevin. Lord Cornwallis. Murph EP. Matt McClellan. Rushy Glenn. Juan Jalapena. Chip Handsome. Matthew Sutton. Tobias Clark, Russell Kasberg, Xavier Jimenez Castilla, Rena Kemp, Ham_Boat, Lip Duck, MC Hamster, Raymond Hernandez, The Crow Fans, but seasonal, Jeff Coffee, Scottie Pippen, still can't believe we got Scottie Pippen on here, that's amazing, Chris Uncle Fart Blimp Nelson, Zach Weir, Meet Virginia, Kieran McNamara, Coleman Laguza, Diet Soda, Woof 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 Woof, A Pair of Scots, Iroh Forte, Meta for the Metaphor, and then some beautiful music notes I'm impressed you got in your username that I don't know if those are actual musical notes, like which ones those are. Meta, let me know if I should sing a certain like tune for you. Estimena, Lord of Paul's Pants, Zambambino,
Ma, the Meatloaf,
Burger's Wonderful World, some of Chad's bird friends. I got some new bird friends. I don't know if I've covered that on the podcast. I should bring it up on the campfire. Nicholas Maloney, Lucretia McEvil, Need More Kimchi, Mutant Astronaut, Logan Derby, Cameron Hansen, Eric Horwitz, Generally Depressing, Philip Reynolds, Nate BitG, Reed Stupidick, Ryan R. Davis, Scott Wabel, Joey Evans, Resident Lorcana Guy, Artist formerly known as Stinklich, Chooch Rules, Mr. Unimportant, Ninja Breadmen, Megan McCormick Mason, Sprinkle Buns, Aaron Lord, SSJ Trogdor, Max Boltzmann, Pharaoh, Mike Spaghetti Jones. I don't know why I did a robot for spaghetti. It's actually a very natural human thing that's not robotic. Speaking of, Robot Arena, Quest, number one Agnes Tachyon fan, Big Nick Lane, Kira and Brian are big fans, Kyle O'Neill, Tacky Tammy, Kiwi of Lerv, Chevy LaGrange, Chris Curto, Jesse Boggs, Michael Malloy, Logan Gilgus, Mr. Bumpy versus the Closet Monster versus Destructo. You know, I think it's time to bring back Bump in the Night. I think that's due for a reboot. Chris Kulik, Dakota Kemp, Time Eats Flesh, Problem Child 2 on DVD. Here's the thing, I actually gotta check to see if it's actually on DVD. That might be a VHS only one. Odin's Eyehole, still a pretty decent dog, generally speaking. Taraku, Kit Bush, Jafar sees your hard work and is proud of you, as am I. I'm proud of all of you. Dennis Wright, Jover the Moon, Dacious, B, Clint Deerking, Jolly Old Jules, Smelodies, Chris can't think of a fun name. Chris, it's gonna come to you. You're gonna have the inspiration. I believe in you. Spencer Leith Johnston, A Dumb Bitch Juice Just Thriving in Her Corpse Bucket. I love that one. I love that every time. Alan MC, R.L. Stein's Leathery Apocalyptic Pepperoni Nipples. I always wonder about apocalyptic, as in like they summoned the apocalypse. They are only exposed now in the apocalypse. It's a great image. It evokes something in me. Nintendo 60 Jorts, Treehouse of Jorge, Complex, Better a Yeti with a Flaw Than a Bigfoot Without, Wyvern, Angus Keith, Big Old Dumb Burb Says Take Time to Be Kind to Yourself. I love that. Treat Yourself. Nathan Galindo, J. Fenn Crane, Jackie Bay, Ari, Andrew, Vensora 13, Snackwell's Cookie Monster, Cameron Murphy, Jack H., Patrick Nielsen, Avery, Snack Reiner, Mike C., and then Mike Simple Name. Is that a more simple name than Mike C.? I don't know. Mike's, you gotta figure it out. Energy. Kid Chaos, uneasily gazing at oars. Varkin Vale. Fog Bread. Just a ghost. Noki Station. And Zane! Thank you all so very, very much for supporting the show. I hope you enjoy these episodes, and I'll see you next time. I love you. Goodbye. You've reached the end of this episode of Stories That Stick. Hosted and produced by Chad Kwan. Hey, that's me. Associate produced by Jacqueline Heidi Kwan. Edited by Ben Ravid. Theme music by Ed Scudder. You can contact us at storiesthatstickpod@gmail.com. And please support the show and get access to bonus episodes and more at patreon.com/storiesthatstick.